From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, can thought heal? But here's what's happening. Well, you get stopped by a police officer. Does he have the right, or she, to go through your cell phone? The Supreme Court justices are kind of split on that. Confronting a right to privacy question in the world of smartphones, the Supreme Court justices sounded closely split on whether police officers should be free to search through the phone of any person who is arrested. Justice Alina Kagan, the newest and youngest member of the High Court, urged her colleagues to insist on protecting privacy. She says that people carry their entire lives on cell phones. She said, if there are no limits, a police officer could stop a motorist for not having a seatbelt buckled, download a huge amount of information looking for some evidence of any kind of wrongdoing. Such a search could include a very single email, bank records, medical records, as well as GPS data that would show where everyone went and where they traveled. We'll see when they make their decision. A sample of tuna caught off the shores of Oregon and Washington State have very small levels of radioactivity from the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, but authors of the Oregon State University study say the levels are so small that you would have to consume more than 700,000 pounds of the fish with the highest radioactive level to match the amount of radiation that an average person is annually exposed to in everyday life through cosmic rays, the air, the ground, X-rays, and other sources. Pro-Russia activists have stormed several official buildings in an eastern Ukrainian city. The problem there continues. They seized the regional government headquarters and prosecutor's office before opening fire with automatic weapons at the main police station. Now, the United States has accused Russia of seeking to change the security landscape of Eastern and Central Europe. But what does this mean for the International Space Station? We are at the mercy of the Russians. We don't have a way to get up there or get back. The Soviets take us up there, the Russians. Let's check in with space historian Robert Zimmerman. Robert, this is going to be an issue if this keeps up.
We're in deep doo-doo, George. What we've got is a very complicated situation. This is something that, I have to admit, I've written about for years now. Congress, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, have dropped the ball for years. Somehow they lived in a fantasy land that we can always depend on the Russians. What happened is that the State Department expanded the sanctions against Russia because of what's going on in the Ukraine this week, and those sanctions might affect some of their future commercial proton rocket launches. It's very complicated. So that's when they finally reacted. Up to now, it's been a joke, the so-called sanctions against their space program. But this was serious. And their deputy prime minister, Dmitry Rogozin, his key quote to me was, if the aim is to deliver a blow to Russia's rocket-building sector, then by default, they would be exposing their astronauts on the ISS. That's us. Sanctions are always a boomerang which could come back and painfully hit those who launched them. It's really a direct threat on whether we can get astronauts up and down to ISS.
Well, that's the thing.
I don't know what's going to happen, to be honest.
Would the Russians be so callous not to bring the astronauts back down? Just keep them up there?
No, I suspect what's going to happen if they do anything. This is mainly, a lot of this might be just negotiating ploy, but one of the things they could do is refuse to bring our astronauts up. But it gets very complicated, George, because they can't operate the station without our help. So even if they can get up and down, and we can't, they can't keep the thing up there without us. So we got a situation where if this war of this power game between the various leaderships of the two countries escalates, you could have a station up there that can't be manned and could fall to Earth. It's a very bad situation.
Yeah, it is.
It's very mild.
And Robert, what are they doing up there anyway?
Well, what was about to start happening is do the research on the station to teach us how to get to interplanetary space. Next year, the Russian and American astronaut was supposed to spend a year together in space. and that's to simulate a Mars mission. I have no idea if that's going to take place right now. There is, of course, medical research that goes on and a lot of materials research that goes on. But the prime reason was to finally start to learn how to build interplanetary ships. And they were about to start doing it. I have no idea what's going to happen, George. It's a bad situation.
Thanks so much. Robert's website, BehindTheBlack.com. Great website. A private company is declaring that it has found what it believes is the wreckage of a plane in the ocean. They're not going to say as much as that they found Flight 370, but leaders of the search for the missing plane are dismissing that claim. Now, the reasons for the skepticism are obvious. The site that the company says it found wreckage is in the Bay of Bengal, which is several thousand miles away from the current search area in the southern Indian Ocean. Subsiding land is a bigger immediate problem for the world's coastal cities than sea level rise, according to scientists. In some parts of the globe, the ground is going down 10 times faster than the water is rising. That could be a disaster. If you have had a heart attack, eat plenty of fiber because it may improve your long-term chances of recovery, according to researchers. Heart attack survivors were more likely to be alive 9 years later if they followed a high-fiber diet, according to the study. Now, fruit, bananas, apples, root vegetables such as carrots and potatoes, wholemeal bread, cereals, bran, they are all sources of dietary fiber. Up next, are we overusing antibiotics? Dr. Martin Blaser joins us. Missing microbes, that's his work, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We are overusing antibiotics to the point that it could seriously affect all of us. As a matter of fact, some experts are saying in hospitals, for example, we might not even be able to have normal routine operations because of all the diseases and the bacteria that's all over a hospital. Dr. Martin Blaser has studied the role of bacteria in human disease for more than 30 years. He's the director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York's University, and he's written a book called Missing Microbes, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Hello, Martin. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
This is a huge, huge problem. How long has this antibiotic issue been festering?
Well, really since antibiotics came on the scene in the 1940s. When they first came on, we knew they were miraculous drugs. They cured people who had incurable diseases, and they still do that today. But more and more doctors have been using it for milder and milder conditions. So that last year, in 2010, there were 258 million courses of antibiotics prescribed in the United States.
Gosh.
That's five courses for every six people.
And I've noticed...
Year after year.
I've noticed, Martin, that they're coming up with newer and newer types of antibiotics. Is that because of the bacteria? They're developing resistance to the old ones?
Yes, exactly. When you subject bacteria to antibiotics, the antibiotics will kill most of them, but some will survive, and the ones that survive are resistant. The more we use them, the more resistance we see.
Is that why doctors will say, look, I've just prescribed you, let's just use the old tetracycline, I've just prescribed you a bottle of tetracycline, take them all? Because a lot of times people will take the antibiotics, and once they feel better or the infection seems to go away, they stop, and maybe the bottle's still, you know, three-quarters full or something.
Yeah, well, actually, what you're talking about is a little controversial now, because as a doctor, that's what I told patients for years and years, but I'm not sure anymore whether that's the correct answer.
Really? How come?
Because when you take an antibiotic, because there are good bacteria and there are bad bacteria.
Right.
You know, when somebody's got pneumonia, that's caused by bad bacteria. But we have good bacteria living in our body. Our whole body is filled with good bacteria.
They die, too, when you take an antibiotic.
When you take an antibiotic, they die, too. So when we're giving these strong antibiotics, like tetracycline or like many others, it's killing more good bacteria than the bad bacteria. So the longer we take it, actually, the more the good ones are dying. So it's actually something that it's going to have to be restudied. We're going to have to look at that problem again so that we can advise people what's the right length.
It's like a catch-22, isn't it?
Well, life is more complicated than we used to think.
No doubt. Now, what is a microbiome?
So the microbiome is all the microbes that call us home, that live in the human body, live in and on the human body, in the GI tract, on the skin, in the mouth, in the birth canal, wherever we have surfaces, we have bacteria living on us. And that's the way it's always been. We got them from our moms, and they got them from their moms, and back into time. Ever since there were animals on this planet, about 500 million years, they've had bacteria living in them.
I feel like a little kid, Martin, back in school, and you're my scientist teacher. But you know, when you talk about bacteria, explain what that is.
A bacteria is a single cell. It's really the smallest unit of life. Our body is composed of trillions of cells, where our cells are kind of working together. There's no kind of one human cell. Although interestingly, humans began as two cells, the egg cell and the sperm cell, and then they split and multiplied, and that's why we have trillions today. But most of the cells in the human body are bacterial cells, are the bacteria that call us home.
So bacterium, one cell, is in your body, it's in your system, it's alive.
Yes.
Does it eat? What does it
yeah,
do?
Yeah, it eats. When you eat, it eats. And in fact, the bacteria help us eat. They help us digest their food. And some of the bacteria, they divide every 12 minutes. Some divide every 20 minutes, some divide every hour, but they're multiplying, and that's how the numbers stay up.
Now, when you say there are good bacteria and then bad bacteria, how do you know the difference?
Well, that's the science of microbiology, and that's the science of medicine and infectious diseases. We have a pretty good idea what the bad ones are. The bacteria that causes tuberculosis, that's a very bad one. The bacteria that causes strep throat, that's a bad one. Then we have many bacteria that are good bacteria with names that nobody in your audience has really ever heard of, because they don't really cause any trouble, so people don't really know about them.
Right.
And then we have bacteria like E. coli, which you've probably heard
of. Oh, we've heard about that one.
Sometimes, most of the time, E. coli is good. Sometimes it's bad. That's where it gets complicated.
Now, let's bring in viruses for a moment. What are they compared to bacteria?
Yeah, viruses are even smaller than bacteria, and there you can think of them as like naked DNA. They need to live in a cell so that they can multiply. A bacteria can multiply by itself. It doesn't need any help. A virus has to live in either a bacterial cell or a human cell for it to multiply. It's a very classic parasite.
Okay, so it's alive. Why does an antibiotic, in most cases, kill off a bacteria, but does not affect a virus?
That's just one of the facts of life. The bacteria are cells, and you can kill a cell. You can't really kill DNA. In a way, a virus isn't quite living in the same way a human cell or a bacterial cell is.
Huh. Okay, so in this wondrous body we call us, and let's assume God put us together, He made us. Why in the heck did He create a virus?
Some of the viruses are good, too. There are good viruses and there are bad viruses. All our good bacteria, many of them have viruses, and they help control the populations of the bacteria. If certain bacteria get too high, their viruses take them down.
They'd be out of control.
Yes. Again, there are bad viruses, the classic, the cold virus, the virus that causes measles, the virus that's HIV. Causes AIDS. Those are very bad viruses, but there are good viruses too.
Would you call viruses generally one of the toughest little critters on this planet?
You know, I'm partial to bacteria. Bacteria have been present in the world ever since there's been life on Earth. That's about 4.5 billion years. And they're everywhere. They're in the water, they're in the rock, they're in the soil. We live in a world of bacteria.
Probably on other planets, too, I would assume.
Probably so.
How does an antibiotic affect a microbiome?
Well, the antibiotics are chemicals, and they're designed to kill bacteria. As you say, the problem is that
we don't have a sign. The bacteria don't have a sign. I'm a good guy and you're a bad guy.
Yeah.
The antibiotic is killing them more or less indiscriminately. And some of them attack the wall of the bacteria so that they break open the bacteria. Some of them attack the DNA of the bacteria. So they have different mechanisms to kill or to inhibit the growth of bacteria.
You say in Missing Microbes, your book, be careful about over-prescribing antibiotics to children. And, you know, I know through my kids when they got sick and my little grandchildren, first thing a doctor prescribes, amoxicillin and antibiotics like that. Why be careful with kids?
Well, and this is what I discuss in Missing Microbes, and this is part of the research that I'm doing at NYU in my lab, because kids are born with they're born without any bacteria, and then they start acquiring bacteria really from the moment they're born, and we know that these bacteria help guide healthy development of kids. Immunologic development, people's kids' immunity, their metabolism, how many fat cells they have, and maybe even the development of their brain. So if we're giving antibiotics early in life to kids, we're changing the bacteria that are responsible for the kids growing up normally. And so that we never thought that bacteria, that antibiotics had a big cost before. We always thought that they were pretty harmless, but we're finding more and more that there are long-term consequences out of from using antibiotics. And the more we use, the worse it is.
What would happen, Martin, if you just didn't give a child or an adult the antibiotic? Just let them try to fight off the bacteria with their own body. What would happen?
Well, you know, that's why we have doctors. Because there are some kids who come in and they're really, really sick. They must have an antibiotic. There's no question that they should have an antibiotic. To not give them an antibiotic would be awful. But most of the kids who come in have very mild infections, and most of them don't need antibiotics. So that's where you need the judgment of a doctor who does a careful exam and says, this child needs an antibiotic. This child does not need an antibiotic.
I remember about 6 months ago, I must have had a little cut on my elbow, but I woke up in the morning and it was bursitis or something. I mean, my elbow was huge. And so I went to the hospital and they lanced it and prescribed some antibiotics. I have no idea what happened and how that happened. How in the heck can an elbow swell up like that?
Well, that's caused by bacteria. Somehow you might have had
a little cut,
microscopic little cut in your skin. The bacteria got in, and then they started to swell. And that's a case where you definitely needed to go to the hospital to have them lance it, to give you the antibiotic. No question about that. But in my book, I contrast the experience between the U.S. and Sweden. You know, Sweden, the people are just as healthy as we are, but at every age, they're using only 40% of the antibiotics we're using.
How can they get by like that?
They do. They get by just fine. And that tells us that 60% of the antibiotics we're using at every age are unnecessary.
And what about cases where somebody gets a cut but goes swimming in a lake and ends up losing the leg or something like that?
That happens. It's rare. Those are people, you know, if somebody has a serious infection like that, absolutely, they need to see a doctor. They may need surgery. They need antibiotics. No question about it. And my specialty, I'm a doctor, is infectious diseases. It's the treatment of some of those very severe infections. But we know that most of the people who go to the doctor, most of the parents who bring their children to the doctor, those kids do not need antibiotics. In fact, the American Pediatric Society and other societies estimates that about 70% of the antibiotics we're giving to kids are wasted.
I would believe that. Hey, are the big pharma, are they pushing that?
You know, a lot of the antibiotics aren't even that expensive, so they're not making that much money. Some of them are, but it's kind of the parents feel deprived. They've gone to the doctor, and they feel deprived that the doctor doesn't give them an antibiotic. The doctor may feel worried, if I don't give an antibiotic and something bad happens, maybe I'll get sued. So
yeah,
that's, again, I wrote Missing Microbes to begin to change the dialogue, to tell doctors, you know how to do a careful exam. Don't just write the script. Do a careful exam. Tell the children, that the parents, this child needs an antibiotic or not. And I want to tell the parents, if the doctor has done an exam and he says your child doesn't need an antibiotic, you should feel grateful.
Martin, when we come back, I want to talk about how antibiotics could be related to asthma, other allergies, and some chronic diseases. I'm George Norrie. We shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, by the way, for you Coast Insiders, this Wednesday, 8 p.m. Pacific time, will be our chat with Coast to Coast guest David Paulides, who's going to be talking about, of course, those missing people in our state and federal parks. So you don't want to miss that. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Martin Blaser with us, Missing Microbes, his work. Tell us the correlation between antibiotics and obesity, allergies, asthma, and other chronic diseases, Martin.
Well, there's more and more evidence that the antibiotic use is helping fuel these diseases. You know, these diseases have become much more common in recent years.
True.
There have been studies now that have compared children who've gotten lots of courses of antibiotics with those who've had very few courses, showing that those kids who had lots of courses are more likely to become obese and to develop asthma, for example. Now, we also know that farmers have been feeding antibiotics to farm animals, their livestock, to do what's called growth promotion.
Yeah.
It makes them bigger.
And they pass it on to us.
And they pass it on to us. But that already establishes the principle that antibiotics are going to affect how those animals grow. And about 10 years ago, a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, if farmers are giving antibiotics to fatten up their farm animals, what are we doing to our kids with all the antibiotics we're giving them?
That's a good point.
And we began doing studies in the laboratory to examine this, giving antibiotics to mice or not, and looking at the difference, and we can show that we can make the mice fatter.
Remember that they would put bovine in feed it to the cows, and it would pass through the milk because they wanted more milk production?
Yeah, the some of the growth hormone.
Yep.
Yeah, so
absolutely.
That's a separate problem, but it's still bad practice.
Absolutely. Going straight through, kids would drink the milk, and there
well,
it was.
Now, you know, there have been surveys in supermarkets that show that sometimes milk is when the farmers give the antibiotics to their farm animals to help them grow more, they're supposed to stop before they send them animals to slaughter, and they're not supposed to use it in milk cows, for example. But there have been surveys in supermarkets that show that sometimes the meat is contaminated by trace amounts of antibiotics. Sometimes milk is contaminated. And for some cities, their drinking water intake is downstream of the effluent from some of these industrial farms. So millions of people are probably taking in trace amounts of antibiotics every day in the United States, and nobody knows the consequence of that. Maybe it's small, maybe it's big. We just don't know.
You talk about C-sections, cesarean sections, and how it could affect a child. Explain that.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that cesarean sections go back 2,000 years or more. But in the old days, they could save the baby, but the mother always died. But for about the last 100 years, the doctors have been able to perfect the operation so both the mom and the baby live. And for many decades, the C-section rate was 5% or 10%. And then it started going up. About 20 years ago, it was 18% in the United States. And today, it's about 33%. One baby out of three is born by C-section. In countries like Brazil, it's 50%. In urban China, it's 50%. We're not talking about small countries. These are places. So one out of two babies is born by C-section. Now, the problem, which people didn't understand before, is that in the old days, or the normal delivery, the baby is born, it goes through the mom's birth canal.
Mm-hmm.
And when it goes through the birth canal, it's picking up the bacteria from the mom.
All kinds of microbes.
These are the microbes that give it its start in life. This is how nature has designed it, not just for humans, but for every mammal. They're all doing it the same way, whether they're elephants or cows.
Horses.
Or dogs,
yeah.
They're all doing it the same way. They're covered with their mom's microbes. And that's part of the heredity we get from our moms. But if the babies are born by C-section, they're missing that.
That's an interesting observation.
Those are some of the missing microbes.
how do you promote healthy microbiome?
Yeah, that's a harder problem. But certainly, we have to use less antibiotics, as I said before, because that's hurting the microbiome. We're also, the stores are selling all these hand sanitizers and antibacterial soaps. There are special cases in which those are important. If it's in the flu season, if you're in a hospital where there are a lot of very nasty bugs, that's important to use that. But for the rest of the people, the millions and millions of people who are using this every day, I'm not sure whether it's doing more good or more harm. Never really been studied, never documented to be good.
Is it conceivable we will run out of antibiotics that could fight the bacteria?
Yeah, well, we have already run out in some regards. For certain bacteria, they're becoming more and more resistant. A very good example is the bacteria called Staph aureus, which causes staph infections. And a number of years ago, there were rare isolates that were resistant to an antibiotic called methicillin. And so those methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, were rare, and now they're common. Not only do people get them in the hospital, but healthy people just walking on the street can get them.
Yeah. Now, what's going on in Saudi Arabia, where they have all these cases of MERS?
MERS. So that's not MERS. It sounds like MERS, but that's
right.
A virus.
That's a virus.
And
there's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah, fortunately, it's not that transmissible, it's not like the flu. You know, if somebody has the flu and you've never had this particular strain, your chance of getting it is about 50%.
The flu is airborne.
It's airborne. And this MERS seems to be airborne too, but it's not nearly as transmissible as flu. So there are a few cases, dozens of cases, hundreds of cases, but not millions of cases.
Now, just yesterday, some scientists said that it's conceivable that because of the issue of so much bacteria in hospitals, that it could change the way operations are done, that they may not even be able to do some of the simplest operations in a hospital.
Yeah, well,
that's scary.
All of modern medicine is based on having antibiotics that work. You know, the surgeons can do more and more complex and difficult surgery because they know they have antibiotics to back them up if there's a problem. Chemotherapy for cancer, that requires antibiotics that work because there sometimes are problems. Transplantation, all of those need antibiotics. If the antibiotics stop working because of resistance, then we're going to be in trouble.
I remember my dentist would tell people sometimes that before they had their teeth cleaned, if they had any potential problems, heart murmurs, anything, take an antibiotic before and after the procedure. They're not doing that anymore. Martin, how come? They stopped it.
Well, they are, but they're not doing it for as many
people.
For certain people who have certain kinds of severe damage on their heart valves.
Microvalve, stuff like that.
They need the antibiotics before and after the dental procedure, what we call prophylactic antibiotics. But again, because nobody really thought that antibiotics had any biological cost, dentists were giving this to millions and millions of people. So they thought the benefit was low, but there wasn't any cost. Now we know probably that for most of those people, the cost exceeds the benefit, and that's why they stopped, except in the severe cases.
Share with us a case or two, Martin, that you've come across where antibiotics didn't work and bacteria just about destroyed the person.
Well, I mean, we see this in all kinds of settings. This is in patients who are getting therapy for cancer, for example. They're being treated with chemotherapy, and their white blood count goes down very low because of the chemotherapy. It's really blasting them. And in the past, we could, if they developed an infection, we could cover them with antibiotics, get them through the worst part of it. But now some of these organisms are very resistant to the antibiotics, and we're losing people.
And this could happen just about with anybody, right? I mean, nobody is immune to this, right?
Well, you know, I was in Missing Microbes, I talk about how I was the president of the Infectious Disease Society of America. That's the organization of doctors who are specialists in infectious disease. And I went to Congress to testify to try to get Congress to change the laws to make it easier to develop new antibiotics. And the congressman who was heading this series said, he said, yeah, I know all about this. I was just playing golf with one of my buddies, and he was going to tell me about a hip operation. And 2 weeks later, I was attending his funeral.
Oh, my
God. Because he developed one of these antibiotic-resistant staph infections.
And he died.
And he died.
I remember back in St. Louis several years ago, the county executive at the time, Buzz Westfall, he had some kind of spinal problem. Something was wrong. He goes in the hospital. They put him in a self-induced coma and because of the infection. But he dies from the infection.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's a kind of a paradox. We're using too many antibiotics, and so that's making development of our kids abnormal. It's also selecting for resistance, which makes it harder to use antibiotics in the future.
If you're mixing antibiotics at the same time, is that dangerous?
Yeah. Sometimes doctors think if one antibiotic is good, two is better. But maybe not. Maybe it's causing more harm to our good bacteria.
What's this craze with these Z-Packs?
Well, the Z-Pack it's called azithromycin. It's a terrific antibiotic. It is really very powerful. It's very easy to administer. It was licensed in 1991. In 1990, there were zero doses of it used. Last year, there were 60 million courses of it used. One course for every five people.
Wow.
And again, that's year after year because it's such a good antibiotic, but it's also overused, tremendously overused.
So eventually bacteria is going to develop a resistance to that too.
Sure.
So what happens theoretically if every antibiotic that's been created on the planet doesn't work?
Yeah, well, then we're in trouble. Then we're back to the year 1900 or so before there were antibiotics, and people would die from strep infections, and they might get a splinter in their skin and get an infection, and they would die. People have their heart valve would get infected. So we don't want to get there. We want to be much more proactive, so that we can save the antibiotics we have, develop new ones, and just curtail the overuse of this, which is in part driving the failure of antibiotics.
What was the first antibiotic? Penicillin?
Penicillin.
And that was developed?
It was discovered in 1929.
A cantaloupe or something.
Right. That was discovered in 1929, but with World War II, there was a need to really develop antibiotics, so it came out in the 40s. And it's made by a mold, the common bread mold, and they found a cantaloupe in Peoria, Illinois, that made huge amounts of that mold that was very productive, and that's where most of the penicillin used now is. It's all from that cantaloupe.
How did they know, by looking at mold on a cantaloupe, that this would kill bacteria? How would they know that?
Well, you know, people knew it. Peasants in Europe knew that if people had infected wounds, they treated it with moldy bread.
Really?
They've known that for centuries.
They'd rub it on you?
That's right. They knew. They would pack the wound with that. People knew. It was part of the folklore. But it took a scientist, Alexander Fleming, in 1928, to see. He had a Petri dish, and he had a bunch of staph on the dish, and he went on vacation. And when he came back, the plates had been sitting around for a long time, and he was throwing them out, and he noticed there was a mold on the plate, and around the mold was a clear area where the staph had been eaten away. And he figured that mold made something that was destroying the staph, and that something, ultimately, he purified it. It was penicillin.
And now what has happened to penicillin? Are there derivatives of penicillin?
Yes. Penicillin is still used. It's still widely used. It's a terrific antibiotic, and there are derivatives like the one you mentioned, ampicillin and amoxicillin and methicillin. These are all different forms of penicillin that have different properties that make them useful. So again, modern medicine is based on having antibiotics available to treat people who have serious problems.
Martin, some people are allergic to penicillin. Their throats swell up. They can suffocate. What happens, sir?
They should not get penicillin again. There are different kinds of allergies to penicillin. What you've talked about is a very severe allergy. Fortunately, that's rare. More commonly, there are people who get skin rashes. Occasionally, they get hives. Somebody who has an allergy should not get penicillin again, but there usually there are plenty of other antibiotics that they can take.
Well, and food allergies, too, like, you know, allergic to peanuts or shellfish. How does that happen? I mean, what is the body trying to react to?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I would say that even today, we still don't know the answer. But you mentioned peanut allergy, and I discussed that in Missing Microbes as well. Because peanut allergy, when I was growing up, was quite rare.
Sure was.
Now it is getting more and more common. So, you know, the question is, where are these allergies coming from? Why has this been growing? And that's one of the theories that I put forth in Missing Microbes, the idea that our bacteria that we acquire early in life is training our immune system, and we're messing it up so that the training is bad. And so that our immune system is overreacting to wheat. There's a lot of gluten allergy, or what's called celiac disease, and nut allergy, a lot of skin allergies and skin sensitization, and of course, asthma. We think that it's all based on the same mistraining of our immune system.
I was on a flight a few months ago, and an individual yelled down to the flight attendant, "Hey, where are my peanuts?" And she said, "We can't serve peanuts on this flight, sir." And he said, "Why not?" And she said, "Somebody here has a peanut allergy." And he said, "Well, they're not going to eat them. Where are mine?" And apparently just the smell or something of a peanut will get this person. How does that happen?
Well, that's the nature of an allergy. That's a very minute dose of something can cause a very severe reaction. That's a classic kind of allergy. Again,
wow.
That degree of peanut allergy is rare, but peanut allergy, it's just exploded. There's so much more of it now than there was 20 years ago or 40 years ago.
What would you do to solve this problem of overprescribing antibiotics? Underprescribing them? I mean, how would you solve this?
Well, again, I mentioned in Sweden, they're using 40% of the antibiotics we are, and they're doing just fine. So we have to change the training of doctors so that they're not as liberal in giving antibiotics. We have to give doctors more time with their patients so they're not rushing through the patients one after another so that they can do a careful exam. And there are criteria that determine this child is sick, they need antibiotics, this child isn't too bad, we're going to give it time. If you think that antibiotics don't have any cost, any biological cost, you'll give it to everybody. But now that we're understanding there's cost, doctors have to be much more judicious. And patients and parents can't be pressuring the doctors, "Oh, give them an antibiotic." They have to understand that there's cost there.
Is it solvable, Martin, do you think?
Yeah, I'm an optimist, and I think it is solvable. And another thing that I discuss in Missing Microbes is that one day, I think there are certain bacteria that our ancestors have that we've lost. These are some of those what I call missing microbes that have gone extinct in our body. And I think that in the medicine of the future, kids are going to be tested for that. And if they're missing something, they're going to get a drink, and they're going to drink it, and that's going to replace the ancient microbes that they thought. That's the concept of a probiotic. And, you know, you go to the health food store and the grocery store, you see all these shelves full of probiotics. Most of those haven't really been tested. So I don't exactly know what they are or what they're doing. But scientifically, we're going to develop real probiotics, and I believe that's going to be the medicine of the future.
Dr. Martin Blaser with us. He's going to stick around, and we'll take phone calls. Maybe you can tell us some of your stories when you were taking antibiotics, his book, Missing Microbes. And, of course, Martin, the book is available now for people?
It's available in bookstores. It's available online from the big sellers, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. The book's doing pretty well.
All right, great. Let's take this little break, then we're going to come right back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with your phone calls. By the looks of things, every line's going to be lit. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.